The story of Genesis is showing the family of Christ. And it traces the people that God would later on use to bring about the Savior. And so, we're told about, obviously, Adam and Eve. They're at the very beginning because they're the first people. And how they sin and how they reject God's goodness for them in the garden. Later on, we're told about Noah and how God preserved his promise that he made to Adam and Eve that someone would come and he would destroy the serpent. And Noah is preserved along with his family. And in addition to that, the promise that God had made to them is preserved through Noah and his obedience, his trust in God, his family. Later on, we're told about Abraham. We read about his life and the promises that God makes to him, that he will make him into a great nation. He will give him the land of promise, and he will give him the seed that will become a blessing to all the people of the earth. Of course, Abraham has Isaac, and Isaac has Jacob. And when you read about these people's lives, each of these people are chosen by God because of their faith, but also in spite of their flaws. You see moments where they trust in God, moments when they obey God, but also times whenever they don't, whenever they reject what God has said or doubt what God has said, and even just flat out ignore or disobey what God has said. So the story of Genesis shows how God is faithful in passing these promises down from generation to generation. And the common question in all of these people's lives is, which of the descendants is going to inherit these blessings? So for instance, we have Abraham, and God makes these promises to him. And of course, Abraham and Sarah don't have any children, so there's the big question mark. How is God going to fulfill his promise, and who is it going to be? So it's 25 years after God speaks to him, that of course they have Isaac. The question of Isaac's descendant, who's going to inherit the blessing, is answered pretty early on in Genesis, because as Rebekah is pregnant with twins in her womb, the Lord, they're struggling together, and she wonders, why is this happening to me? And the Lord reveals to her that the younger will be preeminent over the older. And so Jacob is the one that is chosen. And then Jacob marries two wives plus two concubines, and they have 12 children. And so here's the question at the end of Genesis, which of these 12 children is going to be the one that God chooses to inherit this promise, this blessing of the seed that will bring blessing to all of the people? And it's not until the very end of Genesis that this question is answered. Here in Genesis chapter 49, Israel, also known as Jacob, is pronouncing blessings, or in some cases don't really seem like blessings, more like curses, upon his 12 sons. And in verse 8, he speaks to Judah. He says, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, and his teeth are white from milk." Seems clear here from what Jacob says to Judah, is that Judah is the leader of the family now. Judah is the one that this promise of this king, you notice the language in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from him, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Kings will come from his line. And in verse 8, the father's son shall bow down to you. Judah is the one that God promises that this descendant will come from. Not Reuben, who is the firstborn, not Simeon, who is the secondborn, or not even Levi, who is the thirdborn, but the fourthborn, Judah. And so that raises the question, doesn't it? Typically, it was the oldest son that inherited the blessing. Why did God choose Judah? Why did God choose this son to be the ancestor of Jesus Christ? And that's what the last chapters of Genesis are all about, seeking to answer the question of why Judah. Now, usually when we read Genesis beginning in chapter 37, we look at this as Joseph's story, right? It's the story of how Joseph gets sold into slavery, how he ends up in Egypt, and through a lot of misfortunes and circumstances, he ends up rising to command in Egypt and saving his family. Certainly, the end of Genesis is Joseph's story. But interwoven in Joseph's story is the story of Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, and especially the story of Judah. And so it helps us see why God chose Judah. And Judah is certainly not, at least when you first read about him, Judah is not this shining knight and this character that we would look at as being, oh, this is the one that God would have chosen to bring about the Savior of mankind. In fact, very much the opposite. Judah is not the one that probably we would have chosen to be the seed of Christ. So I want to tell the story of Joseph, but through Judah's eyes tonight, to help us see why God chose Judah. And I believe as we look at how Christ comes from his line, we're going to see some lessons for us tonight. So let's begin with Genesis chapter 37, if you'll turn back there. And we're going to pick up in Joseph's story. Joseph is the favorite of his father, right? And he's the youngest. He's kind of the runt of the lot. He has these dreams, and these dreams indicate that he is going to be preeminent over his brothers. Remember the dreams about the wheat, you know, bowing down to Joseph. And he tells his brothers, and I've always wondered, Joseph, you know that your brothers don't like you already. Why are you going to keep telling them about your dreams? Because it's just going to make them more angry at you. But he does. And he even tells his father and his mother about his dreams, about the stars and the moon and the sun bowing down to him. And even they're incredulous. You think we're going to bow down to you one day? Well, his father sends Joseph to seek his brothers to find out how they are. And when they see him coming from a distance, they say, you know, here comes this dreamer. And here we are in the middle of the field. Let's get rid of him once and for all. And instead of killing him, Reuben says, let's not kill him. Let's, you know, throw him into a pit. And he's hoping to rescue him later. But then in verse 25, if you'll begin there with me, verse 25, then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Judah. To Egypt, excuse me. And Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. So it's Judah's idea to get rid of Joseph once and for all. Think about what he's saying here. Look at his reasoning. He's basically saying, if we kill him, we don't really get anything out of it. We don't profit anything. Plus, we have to lie about it and bear the guilt of that and cover up our murder somehow. Instead, let's sell him to these Ishmaelites, these traitors, so we won't be guilty of laying our hand on him. You notice what he says there? You know, let's not lay our hand on him. Let's let him be somebody else's responsibility. So at least we can sleep better at night knowing we haven't killed our own brother because he's our flesh. Almost as if that makes it better. And on top of that, we make some money. It's almost like icing on the cake. It's a win-win. We get rid of our brother once and for all, and we get money out of it. Think about what kind of a man does this to his own brother. And it says in verse 27 that his brothers listened to him. Judah is leading his brothers, isn't he? He's leading his brothers to betray, to turn against his younger brother. Basically, they're saying to him, hey, you've got a point here. It sounds pretty nice to get rid of Joseph. Now, we noticed earlier that Reuben made an attempt to save him. Notice in verse 21, before this, Reuben heard this, and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. So Reuben tries to save him. Well, Reuben leaves apparently for a time and comes back in verse 30. He returned to his brothers and said, the boy is not here. As for me, where am I to go? I want you to remember that because We're going to see later on something of Reuben's motivations. He's not really thinking about Joseph here. Rather, he's thinking about himself. It's not like he's saying, you know, what have you done to Joseph? I'm concerned about him. He says, where's Joseph? What's going to happen to me? How is this going to impact me? That's his primary concern. Not Joseph, but himself. Well, as we continue in Genesis chapter 38, we get more of a picture of Judah's character, and it's not a very pretty one. The incident that happens between Judah and Tamar paints rather a picture of a very, very ungodly thing. We're going to read this chapter together in chunks here. Let's begin in verse 1. It came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Sheba. And it was at Kezib that she bore him. Now, the first mark here in this chapter against Judah is that he marries a Canaanite woman. It's not the first time that this has happened, but in the book of Genesis, marrying a Canaanite woman was almost a big no-no. Do you remember back in Genesis chapter 24, when Abraham is making preparations for his son Isaac to marry, he sends his servant on a mission, and he makes him swear that he will not let him marry a Canaanite woman, because doing that would turn him away from God. He makes a point. You go back to my family, back in Haran, and you find a wife for him there. And when Esau married a Canaanite woman, or women, not one woman, but women, they created problems for Isaac and Rebekah. And so Judah should have known better than to marry a Canaanite woman. The indication is things are not going to go well from here on out. Well, to pick up in verse 6, now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife, and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord. So he took his life also. And so Judah has three sons, and the two oldest of them are so wicked that God strikes them down. And you don't read of that happening a lot in the Bible. God's, you know, seeing someone's wickedness is so great that he just strikes them down right then. It happens occasionally. But think about how that might reflect on Judah's character as well. Not necessarily, but certainly in this story, I think it does. Verse 11, it says, then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought, I am afraid that he too might die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So think about this from Tamar's perspective. Tamar has lost both of her husbands, basically twice widowed. And the responsibility would be for Judah to give Shelah to Tamar. But he says he's too young. And so he promises when he grows up, then I'll give him to you. But he knows full well that he's not going to do that because he's seeing a pattern in his family, right? The sons that rise up to marry Tamar, they all die. And if I give my last son to Tamar, what's going to happen to him? So he makes this promise to her, this empty promise, knowing full well that he's not going to give him into her hands for marriage. Think about the position that this puts Tamar in. She is a widow, twice widowed. She has no offspring. And you understand that in that culture, a widow would have basically been destitute. No one to care for her, no one to protect for her, no one to provide for her. And Judah just doesn't care. Instead, he makes empty promises to her. Where is his compassion for her? Where is his integrity to do the right thing? And on top of that, to do what he promised. We pick up in verse 12 and we find out that indeed, Judah did not keep his promise. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garment and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat at the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come into you," for he did not know that she was his daughter. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." And she said, "Moreover, will you give me a pledge? Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garment. Catch up here. So after making this empty promise, Shelah grows up, and she is still a widow, unmarried. And so she concocts this plan to dress herself up as a prostitute and sit by the way where she knows that he is going to be. Now the question that I wonder about this is, how did Tamar know that this would work? How did she know that just seeing a prostitute would entice Judah? I think this speaks about Judah's character. She knew something of the kind of person that he was, that she had confidence that just her dressing up would work as a prostitute. You know, she did not make the initiation. She did not make the contact. It was he who approached her. She knew something of Judah's character. I think this speaks of the fact that this was just who he was. Perhaps this was something that he regularly did in his life. If Judah was a man of sexual integrity, then she would have said to herself, "Well, this plan really isn't going to work." But she knew who he was, and so the plan ended up working. Not only has Judah lied to her through his teeth and failed to keep his word, but he's also a man without self-control, and he's immoral. And so he goes into her, and she conceives. Now, picking up in verse 20, when Judah saw the young goat, sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. Now, notice here that Judah is almost keeping his word more to a prostitute, who he thinks is just a prostitute, than he did for his daughter-in-law Tamar. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim?" But they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of that place said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." Then Judah said, "Let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but she did not find her." There's a bit of irony here in that verse 23, he says, let her keep, you know, the things that belong to me. Let her keep my possessions, because we don't want to be found out. We don't want to be the laughingstock of the community. Little does he know that that's exactly what's going to happen. In verse 24, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry." And then Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Again, think about the character of Judah here. He's selfishly concerned about his own reputation. But think about the blatant and the blind hypocrisy of what he says in verse 24. His daughter-in-law has apparently committed prostitution, and the consequence for that is for her to be burned in public, when he himself wants to preserve himself. We don't want to be a laughingstock. It's okay for him to visit the prostitute, but it's not okay for her to be the prostitute. The hypocrisy, the double standard, is so obvious here, so blatant. And then in verse 25, it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "I am with child by the man to whom these things belong." And she said, "Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these." And Judah recognized them and said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again." Think about the influence of Judah's sin in his own family. It was wrong for Tamar to do what she did. It was sin. But he put her in this situation because of his failure to keep his word and to take care of his own daughter-in-law. Again, what she did was sin. I'm not justifying that. But it was Judah who started the whole thing because of his hypocrisy. And finally, only then, when he does become the laughingstock, does he come face to face with the kind of person that he really is, with his own wickedness and with his own hypocrisy. While she is being brought out, she produces Judah's own belongings that identify him as the father of the child. And I believe that in verse 26, we have a key to the story of Judah. When he says, "She is more righteous than I, because I did not give her my son," in this moment, he sees what he is. And it is this moment that I believe changes his character. But we don't see that quite yet. We see him acknowledging his unrighteousness. We see him acknowledging her being more righteous than him. But he kind of falls off the scene for a while. And then we come to chapter 39. And from chapter 39, this is the story of Joseph in Egypt. And think about what a contrast this is to Judah's character. So Joseph has been sold into slavery. He's hundreds of miles away from his family. And he rises to be the head slave of Potiphar's household. And Potiphar's wife is after him persistently every day, begging him, trying to seduce him. And every day he resists her advances. And notice what it says in verse 8, he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" I mean, Joseph is the exact opposite of Judah, because just seeing one prostitute, Judah's turned aside and he's led astray by his own desires. Joseph is pursued every day by this presumably beautiful, rich, powerful woman, and he refuses her every single day because he does not want to sin against God. Exactly the opposite of what his older brother is. So why doesn't God choose Joseph to be the seed, to be the one through whom the seed promise passes through? The question is, why did God choose Judah? Well, first we need to answer the question, why did he not choose Reuben? Well, if you remember in Genesis chapter 35, in verse 22, it came about that while Israel was dwelling in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So Reuben was one who was immoral as well. He slept with his father's concubine. And when Jacob is pronouncing the blessings on his sons, it says in chapter 49, verse 3, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. But uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it, he went up to my couch." So Reuben was not chosen because of his sin. And so that, according to the pecking order, would leave Simeon or Levi. Why didn't God choose them? Well, remember in chapter 34, we have the story of how the men of Shechem are destroyed by Simeon and Levi because Shechem, the leader of that city, had raped their sister Dinah. And so in an act of revenge, it wasn't justice here, but in an act of revenge, they say, you know, "You can join our family, we'll marry Dinah off to you if you circumcise yourself." All the males are circumcised. And while the men are presumably under the influence of painkillers, Simeon and Levi just go and wipe out every male among them. And when that happens, at the end of the chapter, Jacob says to them, "Why have you done this thing? You've made my name stink." And they said in verse 31, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" This isn't justice. This is bloodshed. This is revenge. And yet they have no remorse for that. And so the Lord does not choose them. In Genesis 49, in verses 5 and 6, it says, "Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implement of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamented oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." later on, whenever the tribes are being settled in the land, you remember Simeon, it's hard to pinpoint his boundaries. He's just kind of dispersed within the land. And the Levites aren't even given any boundaries. They're just given cities to scatter them throughout the land because of this. So because of Reuben's sin, he's not chosen. Because of Simeon and Levi's sin, they're not chosen. But again, that leaves the question, why Judah? I mean, Judah is almost the worst of the brothers. They're a rowdy bunch. Granted, all of them are. But Judah was the one who led the rowdiness to betray Joseph and sell him into slavery. We might be able to understand why not Reuben and Simeon and Levi. But why did God pick Judah? A couple of points on this here. One thing that stands out to me is that the Bible does not gloss over or explain away or justify or hide the sins of God's people, even the ones that God uses to bring about his blessings. I think that demonstrates to us that the Bible indeed is true. You know, if the Bible was trying to be a conspiracy, why bring up all of these really gross, embarrassing things about God's people that sometimes make God look bad? But again, as I mentioned, I think Genesis 38 is Judah's turning point, because it comes face to face with who he is, and it's his humiliation that brings about his transformation. We don't ever see Reuben repenting. We see Simeon and Levi even boasting or arguing with their father about what they did to Shechem. And so that leads us to get closer to the answering the question, why did God choose Judah? So let's pick up the story here in Genesis chapter 42. Joseph at this point has risen to second in command over Egypt. And Joseph's brothers have come for food in Egypt. They've heard that there's food in the land. There's this famine across even Canaan. And then in chapter 42, they come and they bow before Joseph in fulfillment of his dreams. And Joseph recognizes them. He knows exactly who they are, but they don't recognize him. He apparently looks like an Egyptian, dresses like them, talks like them. Of course, they never expected Joseph to be in the position that he is. And so because of this, he intends to test them by telling them in verse 15, "By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here." He's asked them, "Is your father well?" And, you know, they've said, we're not spies. We're here to come food. And he insists, "You're spies." And in order to prove who they are, he tells them, "You have to bring your youngest brother here." Joseph wants to see Benjamin, first of all. But he also wants to see how they're going to treat Benjamin, being the youngest and the favorite of his father. Well, the brothers go back to the land with the food. The silver returned to their pouches, and they're afraid for that. They don't know why that happened. And they run out of food. And so they tell their father, we need to go back. And in verse 37, Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him, Benjamin, back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." But Jacob said, "My son shall not go down with you. For his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow." Jacob will not let Benjamin go. And Reuben even makes this grand offer, you know, "You can take my two sons and kill them if Benjamin does not come back with me." Reuben's offer here has often been suggested as bold or, you know, a great leadership offer, but think about what he's doing. He's basically throwing his two sons under the bus, and he's not really offering himself as a sacrifice at all. He's more concerned about preserving himself than really being concerned about his father. Now, why did he think that this would work? How can you convince dad that if your youngest son dies, then you have to kill your two grandchildren? How is this going to work? So Reuben's offer is refused. In chapter 43, we see Judah standing up. And it says in verse 1, "The famine was severe in the land. So it came about when they had finished eating the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, 'Go back, buy us a little food.' Judah spoke to them, however, saying, 'The man solemnly warned us, you shall not see my face until your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we will go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, 'You will not see my face unless your brother is with you.' Then Israel said, why did you treat me so badly by telling the man whether you still had another brother? Why did you have to tell him about Benjamin? And he goes on to say, the man questioned particularly about us and our relatives, saying, is our brother still alive? Have you another brother? So we answered his questions. Could we possibly know that he would say, bring your brother down? And Judah said to his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die. We as well as you and our little ones, I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever. For if we had not delayed, surely by now we could have returned to us. So consider who Judah is here. He's concerned for his family. He realizes we need to eat, so we need to bring Benjamin back. It's not going to work if we don't bring him back. So what he does is he offers himself. You see hints of his changed character here. He's not concerned about solely himself. He's concerned about his father and how his father feels. He acknowledges, we know that you love Benjamin, your youngest son. He's putting himself at risk for the sake of his family. But what really strikes me here is that Jacob trusts him now. In verse 11, then their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. And he sends Benjamin with him. Now, what I wonder about this is, how can he trust his son Judah when Judah has proven himself to be a liar, at least in the case with him and Tamar, right? He did not keep his word. He was not a man of integrity then. How can he trust that he would be a man of integrity here? Something in Judah has changed. Something about his character, and we see that here. We don't see him fully transformed quite yet, but you see he's something different. Now, perhaps at the time, Judah just thought to himself, it's going to be okay. All right, we're going to take Benjamin back, and Jacob's just overly protective. He's just really worried about him, like an overprotected father. What could possibly go wrong? Little do they know that everything is going to go wrong. We come to chapter 44, and I want to read the whole chapter with you, again, in sections. Because here we see the transformation in Judah being complete. So in chapter 43, they come to Joseph a second time, and Joseph sees his blood brother Benjamin, and he's amazed that he's seeing him. They eat together, and it seems like everything is going to go well. There's grain in their bags. He sends them off. And look at verse 1. He commanded his house steward, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of the sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain. And he did as Joseph told him. As soon as it was light, the men were sent away, and they with their donkeys. They had not gone out of the city. They had just gone out of the city, were not far off, when Joseph said to his house steward, up, follow the men. And when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is this not the one from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed uses for divination? You have done wrong in doing this. So he plants this cup in Benjamin's sack again as a test. How are they going to react when the son that their father loves the most looks like a thief? So he overtook them and spoke these words to them. They said to him, why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money which we have found in the mouth of our sacks we have brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever your servant it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's slaves. So he said, let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, but the rest of you will be innocent. Then they hurried. Each man lowered his sack to the ground, and each man opened his sack. He searched, beginning with the oldest and ending with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they tore their clothes, and when each man loaded his donkey, they returned to the city. When Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, he was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. And Joseph said to them, what is this deed that you have done? Do you not know that such a man as I can indeed practice divination? So Judah said, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? And how can we justify ourselves? Notice here that it is Judah who speaks up. Judah was the one who, of course, made himself the guarantee for his brother's safety. And here it is, Benjamin looks like a thief. And can you imagine what Judah's thinking right now? I mean, no one else knows that it really wasn't Benjamin who did this. And so think about what Judah, you know, Benjamin, I had one job, to bring you here and bring you home safely. And now you've blown it. You've ruined it. There's got to be a way out. There's got to be some way where I can preserve myself. But that's not going through Judah's mind, at least not at this moment. In verse 16, notice what he says. How can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves, both we and the one in whose possession the cup has been found. He says, basically, we're guilty. He's not saying we're guilty of stealing the cup. He is not guilty of that. I think what he's saying here is God has repaid us for the iniquity that we did to our brother. They're seeing the misfortune that has happened to them as something that is God's consequence for them selling their brother. In verse 17, Joseph said to them, far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possession the cup has been found, he shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father. I mean, Joseph is giving them the perfect way out. Here's the answer for them. If they're jealous of Benjamin, if they hate him like they hated Joseph, you know, they can go. They can go back home and they can concoct some other story about how Benjamin died on the way. But Judah doesn't do that. Read with me Judah's speech in verse 18, beginning. Then Judah approached him and said, O my Lord, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears. And do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, have you a father or a brother? And he said to my Lord, we have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother is dead, so he alone is left of his mother, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. But we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. You said to your servants, however, unless your younger brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. Then it came about when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. Our father said, go back and buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down, for we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. The one went out for me, and I said, surely he is torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. You notice in this whole thing, Jacob is still calling only Joseph and Benjamin his sons. It's almost like his other sons don't really mean a whole lot to him. My wife bore me two sons, not 12 sons, just two. But you don't see a hint of jealousy in Judah in his speech here. In verse 29, Jacob says, if you take this one from me also and harm befalls him, you will bring him, my gray hair, down to Sheol in sorrow. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. You don't see a hint of hatred or a hint of jealousy towards Benjamin here, even though he could have, he and his brothers. It's interesting, as old as Jacob was, Jacob never outgrew his favoritism of his youngest brothers. Jacob grows in a lot of ways, but in this way he does not. He continues loving his two youngest more than the others. But you know what Judah outgrows? He outgrows his jealousy and his envy of his younger brothers. And so what we find is he offers himself in verse 33. Now therefore, please let your servant remain, instead of the lad, a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father?" Judah's primary concern is his father. What will happen to Dad if I go back and Benjamin is gone? He's going to mourn to his grave. And so therefore he offers himself, "Let me stay instead." And so the story comes full circle, doesn't it? Because it was Judah's idea to sell his youngest brother, the favorite, into slavery. And here he is offering himself as a slave in exchange for his father's favorite son. And interestingly enough, Judah becomes the very first person in the Bible to offer his own life in exchange for another's. And he does this to please his father. And it is this transformation that Joseph sees in Judah that in chapter 45, verse 1, he breaks down in tears. He cannot control himself because he sees the man that Judah is. The one that sold me into slavery is the one that is now offering himself for the brother that I love so much. And I believe that's why God chose Judah. To wrap this up, three reasons I suggest why God chose Judah. Number one, he exhibited true leadership. Not the leadership that he exhibited before, where let's get some money out of our brother. Instead, he puts others before himself and at great personal cost. He truly demonstrated growth, didn't he? From the man who was concerned about himself, getting rid of his brother, very concerned about his own desires, turning aside to a prostitute, lying to his daughter-in-law, not concerned about her well-being, from a life of sin to repentance and transformation and faithfulness, and indeed modeling true sacrifice, just like the king that would come from his lineage, the leader who would come from his lineage. And so in these three ways, I believe that Judah foreshadows the gospel message itself, the gospel of grace brought through Jesus. And I want to conclude by pointing you to the Gospel of Matthew. Because in the book of Matthew, Matthew presents to us Jesus the King. Remember, it was promised that from Judah's line would come a scepter, and it would never depart. From him would come a lawgiver. And so Matthew opens his account by saying in verse 1 of chapter 1, "The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar." It was this relationship, this fiasco between Judah and Tamar, that God chose to bring about the king that would come, the promised one. And in chapter 1 as well, we find that whenever Joseph and Mary are told that they're going to have a son, it says, "She will bear a son," speaking to Joseph here, "and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." Think about the sins that Judah had committed, that he bore on his shoulders, that eventually he was forgiven of because of his repentance. And Jesus' lineage itself shows that the message is for sinners. It is for people who have made terrible mistakes in their lives and people who need forgiving. And the way that this Lord, the way that this King would accomplish their forgiveness is by sacrificing himself. In Matthew 26, Jesus is sitting with his disciples and instituting the Lord's Supper. And it says in verse 27, "When he had taken a cup and given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for forgiveness of sins.'" That's why God chose Judah, is because he looks like Christ, giving himself for those that are guilty. If you're not a child of God this evening, if you're not a Christian, and perhaps you are, or you struggle in some way, I hope this lesson has been an encouragement to you as you thought about your own life and the changes maybe that need to take place in your life. The answer is in Jesus, in his grace. We can change. We can find God's grace. Would you change your life tonight? Would you let whatever you need know? If we can help you in any way, please come to the front and let that be known as we stand.